Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I want to thank the Peace Action Education Fund for inviting me to be here with you today, and also the Princeton Theological Seminary for hosting this conference. So I'm going to follow up on the discussion we've been having with Gabor and with Elizabeth about legal issues around drones, the international legal framework, and then Elizabeth was beginning a long discussion about domestic law focusing on the AUMF. What I want to do is talk about the way in which the administration has been interpreting those legal authorities with a particular focus on some presidential policy guidance. And I want to talk about what we know about that guidance. I'll walk you through what it says, and then what are some of the questions that are still unanswered about what are some of these legal interpretations and the way that they're being applied. So let me start off with the presidential policy guidance. This is guidance that was announced in May of 2013 when the president gave an important national security speech at the National Defense University. He talked about other issues like re-engaging in the effort to close Guantanamo. He talked about, relevant to what Elizabeth was just saying, the notion of the war against Al-Qaeda, and he said that this war, like all wars, must end. But he also talked about drone strikes and how drones are being used and some of the ways in which the administration has tried to put a framework on the way it's using drones and some constraints on it. So let me tell you a little bit about that guidance. It is called, its full title I'll give you so that if you want to look it up, what we have is a two-page summary of the guidance. The guidance itself is a classified document, but there's a two-page fact sheet. And the full title of that fact sheet is U.S. Policy Standards and Procedures for the Use of Force in Counterterrorism Operations Outside the U.S. and Areas of Active Hostilities. The president in his speech talked about the issue this way. He said, America's legitimate claim of self-defense cannot be the end of the discussion. To say that a military tactic is legal or even effective is not to say it is wise or moral in every instance. For the same human progress that gives us the technology to strike half a world away also demands the discipline to constrain that power or risk abusing it. And that's why over the last 4 years, my administration has worked vigorously to establish a framework that governs our use of force against terrorists, insisting upon clear guidelines, oversight, and accountability that is now codified in this Presidential Policy Guidance, or PPG. So let's take a look at a closer look at the PPG, or at this two-page summary that we have of it. What I'm going to do is go over a few of the key points and then talk about some of the questions that remain. So first of all, as you can tell by the title, which talked about the use of force in counterterrorism operations outside the U.S. and areas of active hostility, by its terms, it applies only to actions outside areas of active hostilities. So that's relevant to what Gabor was describing in terms of the laws of war. When we're talking about a zone of active combat, this guidance doesn't apply. In that setting, drones can be used according to the laws of war like other weapons. They have to comply with the laws of war and some of the principles that Gabor articulated, like the principle of distinction, distinguishing civilians from combatants, and proportionality. But they're used according to the laws of war. This guidance is meant to apply, again, outside of areas of active hostilities. So we'll think some more about that. What we see here is that the concern of many human rights groups is with the very use that's covered by the PPG, the use of armed drones away from traditional battlefields, where states target individuals who are believed to pose an imminent threat from long distance and in secret. And thinking about how this new drone technology may make this particular use of lethal force more possible. Now, the PPG states right up front that the U.S. government has a preference for capture. So it's U.S. policy not to use lethal force when it's feasible to capture a terrorist suspect. It also sets out some standards for the use of lethal force, beginning with two overarching principles. One, that This lethal force is not to be used as punishment or as a substitute for prosecution. And second, lethal force, drone strikes, are only to be used to prevent or stop attacks against U.S. persons, and even then, only when no other reasonable alternative is available to address the threat effectively. So those are the two overarching principles that are set forth in this PPG. Then it articulates that lethal force can be used outside areas of active hostility only when the following criteria are met. And here they are. First, there's a legal basis for using lethal force. Second, lethal force can be used only against a target that poses a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. Third, then there are some more specific criteria that have to be met. Near certainty that a terrorist target is present. Near certainty that non-combatants will not be injured or killed. That capture is not feasible at the time of operation. That the government or country in question cannot or will not address the threat effectively. And that there's no other reasonable alternative to address the threat effectively. The guidance also emphasizes that the U.S. will respect international law on the use of force in foreign territories, and there they're referring to the question of state sovereignty, that they will respect the sovereignty of the state on whose territory they are acting. And then finally, they note that the guidance notes that if the U.S. is targeting a U.S. person, so that is typically used to mean a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident. In that case, they will do additional legal analysis to ensure compliance with the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Okay? So that's what's set out in this two-page summary of the Presidential Policy Guidance, or PPG. So what are some of the things we still don't know about it, or what are some of the questions that we have about its meaning? Well, we've talked about how it applies to areas outside of active hostilities. So where then does the PPG apply? Which places in the world are considered areas of active hostilities and which are not? Elizabeth talked a little bit about that when she talked about where the AUMF might apply or not. How does that intersect with how they think about active hostilities in terms of whether this guidance covers the use of drone strikes? Well, probably not Afghanistan. Certainly not through till the end of last year, where we were involved in combat in Afghanistan. Has that changed with the end of combat operations there? Well, some recent reporting suggests that even with the formal end of U.S. combat operations in December, Afghanistan continues to be considered an area of active hostilities, at least for much of this year. And that seems to be both about the nature of what's happening on the ground there and also the nature of the continued presence of U.S. forces there through this year. So this PPG probably doesn't apply in Afghanistan. And so again, what does that mean? It means they're following the laws of war in terms of engagement, not these specific rules. What about Pakistan? Well, it's hard to say. But we can assume that it probably follows a similar course and will be treated the same way as Afghanistan, at least the areas of Pakistan that are near the Afghan border, because those have tended to be seen as part of the Afghan theater of war. And there's also a force protection rationale, that it is there's a need to protect U.S. forces fighting in Afghanistan from cross-border attacks. So, and again, there's some recent reporting that suggests that these questions are likely to go in parallel. But we don't know for sure because the use of drones in Pakistan is not something that's publicly acknowledged. What about Iraq and Syria, right, and the current fighting there against ISIL? Does the PPG apply to drone strikes there? No, it does not. That is because it's clearly an area of active hostilities, and the White House affirmed in the fall that because it's not outside of active hostilities, but rather it is active hostilities, that the PPG would not apply there. What about Yemen or Somalia? Well, we don't know for sure. The administration has not stated clearly whether it's following the rules of the PPG there, or rather it's following the laws of war that govern drone strikes. And in Yemen, as with Pakistan, the U.S. government doesn't acknowledge or discuss the use of drones. So it leaves us with some questions about, we've got this set of rules that is meant to constrain the use of drones away from recognized battlefields, away from where, as Gabor described, the laws of war apply to the use of lethal force. But we don't exactly know where in the world is it being applied. Another question we don't know is the meaning of some of the key terms that I was describing that are used in the PPG. One of them, and one that you'll hear more about today, but I want to flag for you now, is imminence. Gabor talked about how, under human rights law, away from an armed conflict, states can use lethal force to repel an imminent attack if they don't have another alternative to address or remedy that threat. Well, the PPG uses the term continuing imminent threat. What does that mean? The term itself is not explained in the PPG, in the two-page summary. It may be explained in the full classified document, but it's not explained in the two-page summary that we have. So that raises some important questions about how expansive is this interpretation of the term imminence under international law. It seems, by using the term continuing imminent threat, to be referring to an unspecified adverse action at some undefined point in the future. But again, we don't know what this term means. And so how can we think about whether that term is consistent with the way we understand or other interpretations of the term imminence under international law? Another thing that I mentioned was this question of feasibility of capture and the preference for capture, and to use lethal force only when capture is not feasible. Well, that raises questions about how is the feasibility of capture defined? And how is it determined? We don't know. Another question is the criteria for being determined to be a lawful target. One criterion that we've just discussed is continuing imminent threat, and we've talked about what that means in the administration's interpretation. But how else is that determination made, that a specific person can lawfully be targeted, can lawfully be killed by a drone? The PPG, the two-page summary, says that there must be a legal basis for using lethal force. And it gives the example of a senior operational leader of a terrorist group or part of the forces of such a group. But again, how would they arrive at that conclusion with respect to a specific individual? These are questions that we don't know. And then even if they determine somebody may be a lawful target, how then do they reach the decision to go ahead and target them? How do they apply the criteria that is set forth in this document so that we can understand how someone is actually made the subject of a targeting decision? Another thing that we don't have is the number and identities of those who've been killed in drone strikes. We only know a few. One of the examples that the president actually spoke about in his speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013 was the strike against Al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen in Yemen. And he lists that Al-Awlaki and I believe three other people were killed in that strike. That information was declassified and spoken about by the president. But we don't have a full understanding of the numbers and the identities of those who are killed, which is important in so many ways, both for knowing what is happening, for being able to assess the policy, and assess some of the questions that we've been talking about today. And then, this is an important point. Even if we could answer all of our questions about this guidance satisfactorily, if we had more information and we could say, you know what, that is an appropriately constrained policy, or we think mostly they've tried to put some constraints on it that make sense. Another critical question is, how do we know if it's actually being followed in practice? You can have the right policy, but you have to follow it in practice. And of course, we don't have information about whether the standards they've set forth for themselves as constraints are actually being followed. And so much of that has to do with the amount of secrecy that surrounds the use of drones. So that is the PPG. I do want to take a minute to just note another way that we've learned some information about the U.S.'s legal interpretations of its authority to use drones. And that is from litigation. That will be discussed in more detail this afternoon, but I do want to note that that's another way. One way has been the information that the president has put forth in his speech and in this summary of this classified guidance. But another way, a source of information about these issues has been litigation, and it's a potential way of learning more about U.S. policy and practice. And the primary example here is the lawsuit around the Al-Awlaki case. And in that case, both the New York Times and the ACLU brought suit for disclosure of the government's legal opinion, which was the basis of the strike against Al-Awlaki, who, as I mentioned, is a U.S. citizen. The Federal Court of Appeal for the Second Circuit ordered the release of a redacted version last year, and so the legal opinion was actually made public by the government in response to that decision. As you'll hear more about, this is about the targeting of a U.S. citizen only. So while it's really important that we know that and that information was released, it's obviously much narrower than it's much narrower lens and much narrower than what's happening because the vast majority of people who are being targeted are not U.S. citizens. But still, I just wanted to note that that is another way we've learned something, and this legal opinion is out there and is something that you can read that gives us some insights into how they're grappling with these bodies of law that we've been discussing today, the law of war, the international law of self-defense, human rights law, and then domestic law that is related to these concepts, the AUMF, the authorization to use military force, and then other principles of constitutional law that would apply in the case of a U.S. person. So I want to turn now to talking a little bit about this question of transparency, what we don't know and what we need to know and why. And in particular, I want to focus on post-strike assessments and redress for harm. It's really important to place a focus on efforts to have less secrecy and more transparency when it comes to drone strikes. Doing more to assess strikes after they happen and to provide redress where it's warranted is not only a critical part of government accountability and a commitment to the rule of law, but it's also critically important in human rights and moral terms. If a strike caused harm to a civilian in armed conflict, or if the government unlawfully targeted someone outside of an armed conflict, that's really important to know. And doing an assessment gives the government an opportunity to try to make that right, or to at least do what it can to make amends. Now, even if the government may be resistant to making public some aspects of the policy, it should be willing to conduct much more thorough and meaningful post-strike assessments. And what's critical there is that they be more independent than they've been. They obviously shouldn't be done by the same people who were involved in the strike. And then to provide for redress. This is not unprecedented. The U.S. military offers compensation in the form of what are either called salacia or condolence payments, in armed conflicts for civilian harm. And the military has done that in the Iraq War and in Afghanistan. So this is an idea that could be extended, potentially, to drone strikes. Even the CIA director John Brennan, during his confirmation hearings in 2013, said this about strikes that happen outside of declared war zones. He said, "Where possible, we also work with local governments to gather facts and, if appropriate, provide condolence payments to families of those killed." Now, the challenge we face in talking about this issue, of course, is that drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen are secret and not publicly acknowledged by the government. But it's something that they could do, and it's not unprecedented. And this is the beginning of trying to understand and assess what is the policy and is it being followed. And if they arrive at conclusions that either mistakes were made or that harm was caused, can they take steps to address that? So I just want to finish with this thought. When we think about the legal questions that we've been discussing today and how it applies to drone strikes, it's critically important to achieve greater transparency and accountability, both as a check on the use of this power and to ensure redress for civilian harm and unlawful targets. Opening up government action to scrutiny can help ensure drone strike policy is sufficiently constrained, that it complies in practice with domestic and international law, and it can help make the use of lethal force more accountable. both in terms of providing redress where it's warranted and in promoting public scrutiny. So how can we achieve greater transparency? Many human rights groups have been calling for that, and it has been a challenge. Well, I want to indicate one small ray of hope, and that has been some limited disclosure thus far of drone strikes conducted by the military in Somalia. In December, the Department of Defense stated that it had carried out a drone strike. It said when. It said it was against a senior operational leader of Al-Shabaab. They gave his name, and they explained his role within Al-Shabaab, and they said the region in the country where the strike had taken place. They had the Pentagon press secretary describe this strike, and then they put out a small press release. Now, this is a very small step, just a dipping of the toe in the water, but it is a start. And hopefully it's something we can build on in pushing for the government to disclose more, at least after the fact, about these strikes. There's another important potential change that we could try to make, and that is to transfer the authority to conduct strikes from the CIA to DOD so that the authority resides wholly with the Department of Defense and that the CIA is no longer involved in conducting strikes. This has been discussed for well over a year. But what first seemed to have some traction and an idea that might move now seems rather stalled. So putting DOD solely in charge won't solve the problem entirely. There's still going to need to be a push for transparency and accountability. But there's fairly widespread agreement that DOD is where the use of lethal force belongs in the first instance. And it's likely to be more transparent than if the use of drone strikes remains in the CIA. Another thing to consider is that we are approaching the end of the Obama administration. There are 2 years left. And as the president looks to his legacy and the authorities and precedents that he's going to leave behind to his successor, the president will likely want to ensure that the use of armed drones is appropriately constrained. And indeed, he acknowledged the importance of such constraints and of greater transparency and oversight in his speech in 2013. So now, at the end of the administration, presents an opportunity to advocate for achieving the goals that he laid out in that speech and to see that they're met by the end of his term. So I just want to close with two important thoughts for us to think about as we look to the future. One is that it's important to consider the precedent that the U.S. is setting in a world in which drone technology is proliferating. How will other governments use this technology against those they identify as threats? And how do we ensure this power is sufficiently constrained and transparent so that there can be accountability for the use of lethal force by states? That's what makes this discussion so important. And secondly, it's also really important to understand whether this drone technology and other kinds of technology that will surely follow will lower the barrier to the use of lethal force against individuals and what that means for a future where human rights, democracy, and peace can thrive. Thank you.